Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, we take a closer look at the unbuilt, playing homage to the buildings that never were and the grand designs that never made it off the drafting board. First up...
It's like you're going to build some of these buildings somewhere else. They were, you know, meant for a certain place at a certain time, but ideas don't die and... Buildings are not just bricks and stones and windows. They're made up of ideas.
We take a tour of unbuilt buildings in New York with one of the co-authors of a book on the subject, Never Built, New York. Next.
It is an old lady. It's a majestic sort of thing. It has a sort of Naples look.
We visit a market in Porto where some want to make sure that a planned refurbishment remains unbuilt. And we finish off the show by talking to photographer Simon Phipps about his new book, Brutal London. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. When people talk about architecture, it's almost always about buildings that already exist. But built buildings represent only the tip of the architectural iceberg. Beneath the surface, thousands of plans and ideas that never see the light of day. New York is a city that inspires architects to dream big, and because of that, it's been the planned site for some of the most prominent unbuilt buildings in history. Now there's a book, Never Built New York, that brings some of the most notable examples together in an expansive hardback volume with a foreword by none other than the architect Daniel Libeskind. On a blustery day in early December, one of the book's co-authors, Sam Lubell, took Monocle's Clarissa Farr on a never-built tour of New York.
Right now, we're right on Columbus Circle, which is a great place to look at several of them. As you can see, it's pretty loud, pretty noisy, pretty crazy with traffic and people here, which is a good place to start because one of the plans for Columbus Circle, it was actually designed by the same architect who designed the building that we're standing in now, Edward Durell Stone. And he wanted to ring it with columns. And the columns were actually going to come directly from the columns at the recently destroyed Pennsylvania station. Yeah, and unfortunately that plan never came to be because the budget wasn't there, and I think the popular will at the time wasn't there to do something like that. And there was another plan for the circle in general by a Polish architect that basically nobody knows now, but he was great. His name was Matthew Nowicki, and he died young, unfortunately, and his archives have incredible drawings of a plan that he wanted to do for a shopping center, similar to what the Time Warner Center is now, but instead of being in the base of a building, it would have been raised above Columbus Circle. So entirely above us would have been a ring, sort of a donut-shaped building, lined with glass.
Is this typical of a city, I guess, that there are so many proposals?
It's a good question. Specifically, like architects like Nowicki, yes, we have several kind of architects that did things that were more speculative. Although this was not a pie-in-the-sky idea. He was talking to urban planners. He was actually invited by one of the city's major urban planners to come up with the shopping center. So this was meant to be a real thing, unfortunately. A lot of times when things are as adventurous as what he was planning to do, they don't get approval for various reasons, money reasons. People are just afraid. And we tried to get mostly projects that were close to happening, that were realistic, because it gives you a real sense of how close we came to being a different place and how the city works. But there are some that you just can't leave out. We found never builts in archives all over the country. Obviously, most of them in New York. But really what you do is you read books, you look through history, you find out who the most important architects were through the course of New York history, then you find out where their archives are. And the majority of them, I guess almost half of them, were at the Avery Archive at Columbia. So you start finding out where all the archives are for architecture all over the country, which is fun. And the original materials you find in there are incredible. You also find things in newspapers, magazines, in books, architecture firms that still exist, private collections. People that know a lot about the city will tell you more. It's definitely a treasure hunt. It's a fun way to find things that you can't just look up never built on Google or at the library. You have to really dig. And that's the challenge, but it's also really fun.
Is funding the main roadblock that stopped all of these projects? Or do you think it does say something about, I mean, a city has to function and has, you know, people on a board making a decision. Yeah, why doesn't New York just look like this crazy futuristic thing?
Really what makes a building happen is money. You see every time there's a downturn, huge collections of never built. So you have the Great Depression, you know, dozens of these projects that didn't happen, and recent downturn as well. So it lost so many skyscrapers and ambitious plans that didn't happen. But you also have political reasons, fighting between New York State and New York City, fighting between developers in the city. That happened all the time, all the time.
Does it affect the way that you look at cities?
I call it never built brain. Everywhere I go now, I see visions of what was going to happen, which can make you go a little bit nutty, but also is fantastic because it's fun. You have a different view of the city and what it could have been, and also just kind of your imagination sort of takes over. But it also, it's a great way to look at the city. Everybody studies this city, especially New York, based on what was built and what that tells us. But there's so much to be learned from what wasn't built.
Are there a few projects that you think that you can really practically see them coming to life?
I don't know if the projects will be picked up one-to-one. I don't know if somebody's going to say, oh, we've have to now build that shopping center over Columbus Circle. But the ideas in them are often salient, and people get inspired by them. Like, oh, wait, somebody wanted to lift an important pedestrian thoroughfare over the city. That sounds like the High Line. Or, you know, glassy structure over a major thoroughfare. Oh, maybe we could do that in Union Square. Maybe we could do that somewhere else. There's always good ideas. It's not one-to-one. It's not like you're gonna build some of these buildings somewhere else. They were, you know, meant for a certain place at a certain time. But ideas don't die. And buildings are not just bricks and stones and windows. They're ideas. They're made up of ideas.
So what are we standing in front of?
So you can hear the fountain. We're standing right in front of the Metropolitan Opera at Lincoln Center. We know from looking at the archives at Columbia University, the Avery Archives, that Wallace Harrison, who designed the Metropolitan Opera, had a lot more plans for this that were never built. And most of them, at least structurally and architecturally, were a lot more ambitious than this plan. And my favorite was a plan that Greg, my co-author, and I call The Foot. And it sort of looks like, you can see Lincoln Center here, there's these really long, tall arches, and those would have been the toes. But then rising up from that would have been, instead of just a square that the Met Opera is, it would have been lifting up like an ankle, I guess. Wouldn't get all the way to the leg, but you'd see a form that looks sort of like a foot, literally.
You said your next project is the Never Built exhibition. Right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, yeah, the Never Built New York exhibition will be held at the Queens Museum, which is in Flushing, right on the site of the World's Fair, both in 1964 and I believe it was 39. And the Queens Museum is actually the site of the New York State Pavilion for the World's Fair. And it contains the panorama of New York City, which is a giant model of New York that if people haven't been to, they need to go to. And we're going to be able to work within the panorama and build never built buildings and other elements into the panorama. So it's going to be an amazing resource for understanding what was never built and understanding the city. And we're also going to have original drawings, original models. We're going to build some models. So it's going to be a great way to understand and a great way to really experience this other world, this never built world. We all just think New York is New York, but literally everywhere you look, things were not just thought of as being different, but they were, like, in many cases within a hair's breadth of being totally different. But if we want people to talk about cities, we want to get architecture and urban design on people's radars and on their agendas. And if people start caring about it, they'll start caring about their cities, and then we'll make better cities. And that's really, at the end of the day, the biggest goal of all.
That was Sam Lubell, author of Never Built New York, speaking to Monocle's Clarissa Farr. The book is available now from Metropolis Books.
Okay, so 2016 wasn't the greatest of years. But don't worry, there are plenty of reasons why 2017 will be better. And we've packed lots of them into more than 250 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look over the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. From the rising global powers to keep an eye on, to the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. It's packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2017. The Monocle Forecast. Buy your copy today and know what's happening tomorrow.
Now, there's a reason why so many buildings remain unbuilt. Most of the time, getting something built is incredibly difficult. There are financial constraints, clashes between clients and architects, and a myriad of other logistical difficulties. But there's also the fact that the architecture around us is loaded with political and social meaning. And so which buildings to build and what to do with the ones already built is the source of heated debate all over the globe. We're going to head to Portugal now to take a look at a building at the centre of such a debate. Porto has a stunning 19th century market called the Mercado de Bolhão. It's the only one selling fresh produce in the city, and it's fended off sell-offs in the past with its traditional trade and stunning architecture resisting predatory developers and encroaching touristification. But now City Hall plans to renovate the market and upgrade it for the future. Not everyone is happy with the plans. We sent Monocle contributor Saima Tariq over there to investigate. She spoke to Porto Mayor Rui Moreira, as well as some of the stallholders affected by the plans, to see how this important site for the city can be saved from degradation while keeping its soul alive.
Though it is in the heart of Porto's rapidly changing city centre, walking into Bulhão Market feels like going back to another time. The neoclassical building, which is in effect a public square connecting four streets, is a singular structure dating back to 1850. Seagulls and cats hang around the fish stalls, while crumbling pillars tower over huts selling fresh produce. Here, the average age of the specialised traders, from greengrocers to florists, is around 67 years old. More than half of them have been selling in this now degraded site for three decades. Although it feels like walking right into a Dickens novel, Mercado de Bulhão has seen a lot of changes in its time. Around 7 years ago, there was a plan to privatise, with developers dreaming up a new shopping mall and luxury homes to replace the market itself. Strong civic movements rose up, and thankfully, it was financial mismanagement that ended up killing the project. As a young boy, Rui Moreira spent many mornings here, going vegetable shopping with his grandmother. He's still recognised by many of the traders today. Now, he's the mayor of Porto. And he's charged with a difficult task, saving the market from degradation without destroying its soul.
It is an old lady. It's a majestic sort of thing. It has a sort of Naples look. Basically, we are going to keep the building visually as it is. So it's a renovation. From an historical point of view, we want to maintain everything which we believe has to do with the heritage of the building itself. But this being said, what we need to do is to prepare the market for the future in terms of comfort for the people who work there and for the people who visit. And also we have to make sure that with the new inflow of customers that we are able to supply the market. So what we are going to do is underground, under the market, we are going to build a basement, a technical basement, where we will have all sorts of facilities for the sewage. We had to divert the river which passes under the market that is already started. We really have to keep the market as it is from a visual point of view, but of course with all the modern conveniences. And that's a very tough thing to do.
The 28 million euro project includes protective and temperature controlled awnings, elevators, connections to the underground station even. And controversially, there will be new restaurant spaces on the upper floor.
Upstairs, what we want to do is some traditional restaurants, coffee shops, and we want to have an area for exhibitions. When we mean exhibition, we are not really talking about only about art exhibitions. In these corridors, we want to be able to sell, for instance, the fruit of the season. You know, we have the time of the cherries, and we want to have the cherry fair there. So we want to attract vendors who are not traditionally there, who are not every day, but they can come from the outskirts of the city and sell their products when it's in season. We are not going to have any big restaurants because the space is just not there. But we want it to be the experience of the market. We will encourage very much the business that goes there to use the goods of the market, the fruit of the market, the seafood of the market. That I think it makes sense, yes.
The current structure is testament to the great work carried out way back in 1914, the last time the market was reconstructed. The reinforced concrete, mixed with metallic structures, wooden roofs and granite stone masonry, is a symbol of Porto's stunning urban history.
We chose an architect, it's a young architect, Nuno Valentim, but he had won the main heritage competition in Portugal for architecture, which is Prémio João de Almada. When we first presented the project to the National Heritage Authorities, it was very important that they would approve because they had classified the building very recently. The building was only classified a few years ago, and they approved. Then it showed us that we had chosen the right architect in the right way. Another thing is in the inside hall, we had some constructions which were not in the origin of the building. They were built by the merchants. And of course, it's like huts. And some of these huts, some of the more conservative people, they said we should preserve them. We will preserve only two of them as a memory. But what we are going to do is like a winter garden inside in glass, where the merchants and the people who will be buying there can have comfort. They can be protected from the rain, from the extreme heat. The products will be protected. We have doves, we have seagulls, we have rats, and we have cats. We have to stop that from being in the middle of the fish.
The scale of the works means that the 90 or so existing traders will have to be moved out for 2.5 years to the basement of a nearby shopping mall. Not all of them will return. Cristina, who has decided to come back, has run a fish store here for over half a century, but she is still against Bulyao's renewal.
After 55 years in the market, born and raised here, after so many years they offer 6,000 euros a compensation to leave. It is shameful that we have such a mayor who never sold anything in Bulyao. Now it is going to be more gourmet. I cannot believe that it is going to stay as it is now. The mayor is, I'm disillusioned by him. He has pulled the rug out from underneath us, our traditions. A traditional market is like this, not like a fair, but like a traditional market, like Bulyao, which has been like this for 100 years.
The people who work there, they are suspicious for a good reason, because of neglect. When we told them they have to move temporarily, some of them said, are we ever going to come back? Some of them, the average age of people who work there is over 65 years of age. For all these people, 2.5 years is an eternity, because maybe they are not coming back. So what we did is we said we will make an advertising campaign that has never been made. We are doing it this Christmas. We are saying, buy there. We are using the real people. We want them all to stay and to sell what they are allowed to sell. If they don't want, for some reason, they can leave. But we thought we should have some sort of shock absorber for people who really are afflicted by this idea that for 2.5 years they will be away and they will never live enough to come back because they are 8 years old. But it's not insulting or humiliating. If they think it's humiliating, they can just say, we don't want.
One obvious risk here, as in other touristic cities, is gentrification. In this case, through the rise of overpriced gourmet restaurants. Something that Maria, an elderly fruit and veg seller, is very suspicious about. Sara, another fish vendor, is expecting hordes of tourists once the market reopens.
People are already aware that there are many tourists. I provide the fish to these two restaurants over there. The fish goes from here to there. For this reason, we are going to sell more to tourists, and there will be a lot more, of course. Is that not good? I think it will be a huge source. Everybody is going to want to come here because, despite everything, our country is well placed.
As old markets across Europe are being transformed into expensive food halls, some worries here are understandable. Even in Lisbon, the old Ribeira market is now owned by Time Out, with a huge section dedicated to higher-end dining. But Porto's mayor insists that this is not what he wants.
It's like the Covent Garden. I like the Covent Garden very much, but it's not a market anymore. Or Les Halles, it's not a market anymore. We want to have a market, and we think the cities really need to have the old markets again. We don't want a supermarket there. It would be very easy to sell it for a supermarket. There would be, obviously, everyone would be interested because it's prime location. We are talking of a beautiful building in a beautiful place with all facilities, with parking lots, with the underground and near the train station. Anyone would want it, but that's not what we want. No, I don't think that's what the city needs, and it's a different decision from Mercado Ribeira. And I have nothing against Mercado Ribeira. I think it's a beautiful project in itself, but it's not a market. It's a hall. It's a food hall, a food court.
The fact that such an old, unprofitable building is still standing in the centre of Porto is kind of a miracle, considering the major developments afflicting historic sites all over Portugal. But Bulyao's future depends on a careful balancing act, one that takes into account the needs of the citizens who want a better city, not just visitors who want a pretty structure. For Monocle in Oporto, I'm Simon Tarek.
A change of tack now to finish up today's show. We're going to turn our attention from unbuilt buildings to some that are very much built and have been meticulously documented. Simon Phipps is a photographer and the author of Brutal London, a handsome collection of black and white photographs of brutalist buildings in the UK's capital. He joined me in the studio to have a chat about the book, and I began by asking him if brutalist structures lent themselves particularly well to photography.
They are particularly expressive buildings. The materials used are very textural. I mean, if you look at a building like the National Theatre, for example, you can see every individual piece of timber that was made used in the mould making for that. It's a particular form of construction called in-situ concrete, and basically huge moulds are made and concrete is poured into these, and the grain of the wood is left on the timber and is obviously cast into the concrete once those boards are pulled off. So you can literally see every single piece of timber that was used in those mould constructions. So you've got that wonderful texture, and the way that light and shadow play across those buildings can be just phenomenally beautiful. It's certainly given me a great appreciation of the properties of these buildings, what they're initially intended for, and almost the politics of them, because I think although there is a great popularity in brutalism at the moment, it's possibly more of an aesthetic one rather than a political one, and it's more about style than a more social dimension. And obviously the propelling force behind most of the brutalist projects was this desire to provide an urgent requirement for housing immediately after the Second World War. So these estates were, and many of the civic buildings were, built with great social purpose, fulfilling an urgent need and provided by the welfare state, which was an amazing thing. And it seems now those particular values, the social and political values, are sort of been left behind somewhat and been discarded in favour of a more stylistic and aesthetic response to what brutalism meant or is perceived as being. So you have buildings like Balfron Tower over in East London, which has currently been decanted, which is a horrible sort of developer's term for basically the residence being removed. And it's been sold off to private developers to fund the rest of the housing association's building remit, and they will become effectively luxury apartments for people with more money than the tenants who live there at the moment. And it's not an answer to the housing problem at the moment to consider this idea of regeneration that is proposed, whereby either the buildings are demolished or repurposed. It certainly doesn't solve the housing problem.
We can perhaps just wrap up by talking about the design of the book itself, because it is a really beautifully designed volume. Were you involved in the design process closely?
Relatively closely. I spoke with the designers, a great company called Apfel, and they had this idea that we should go back to original sort of source material, design material of the time, so late 50s, 60s. So we were looking at old copies of Architectural Review, Concrete Quarterly, and all sorts of periodicals at that time. And they came up with this kind of this feel for it, which kind of references back to those in terms of the colour stock that's used in it and the typeface. They developed their own typeface for the cover, which looks fantastic. So, yeah, they really did their research, and I feel it has, as well as having a very contemporary feel, it also definitely refers back to the design of the time.
Simon Phipps there talking about his new book, Brutal London, which is available now from September Publishing. Next week's edition of the show is going to look back on some of the best features we've had on Section D in 2016. And today I'm going to leave you with a preview of one of those items. It's an interview with Angela Brady, the former president of REBA and a principal of Brady Malalou Architects here in London. She spoke to Josh Fennett all about women in architecture. Here's Angela.
Zaha Did was our star, our role model. She was a strong woman, and there was no need for her to say, "I'm a woman architect." You know, because that automatically brings in, do men say, "I'm a man architect"? Architects are trained in the same way whether you're a woman or a man. We have the same skills. But it's the perception of some people that still carry prejudices in this day and age that, you know, it's like people used to think of women drivers. Oh, she's a woman driver. It's just stupid. In medicine and in law, the kind of equality is much better. And I think that maybe it's because they are professions that don't have a male domination. Like on building sites, we're always dealing with contractors. And I think that's great as a woman. It's to my advantage in many ways because I have very good communication skills. And it's very easy for me to get the right finish with a bricky or blocky because they want to be respected as well as I want to be respected.
So do you think women in architecture, actually there's a kind of practical side when you're doing a building that there might be a certain forcefulness associated with being male, whether that's true or not, we can debate till the cows come home. Do you think men are perceived to be better at these things, or do you think that is an attitude which is, thankfully, you know, we're coming to undermine and people are realising that it shouldn't be a male-dominated industry?
It's male-dominated mainly because when women get to the age of having babies, which for architecture is 34 years of age, there's not enough support from their partners generally. Not necessarily their male architectural partners, but from their partners. And I think that until men actually take more responsibility with child rearing, that we're always going to have that problem where women take a couple of years out maybe to have children because the cost of a nanny or a childminder is quite a lot when we are the lowest paid of all the professions. So it's to do with low fees, to do with low salaries, to do with childcare. And that is the biggest obstacle that we women have. And it shouldn't be there.
That was Angela Brady speaking to Josh Fennett. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, and the man behind the glass, Toby Hammond. If you've got any comments or queries, then email me. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And please leave the review on iTunes if you get the chance. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.